Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. Sorry for the delay. We have a couple of members who are stuck in northbound traffic in Eugene. I want to open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4094. Mazen is here for a brief summary.
All right. Morning, Mr. Chair, members of committee. Interesting. This is the first time I'm here with you this session.
We've missed you.
We've been doing all the heavy lifting, and now I bring you the stuff that I've been enjoying, finance and marijuana. So the House Bill 4094 comes to you with a -A6 amendment that doesn't differ much from the bill itself, except with certain definitions, especially on the trust company and who could represent the different institutions, being the employees of the institutions as well. So the main idea of this bill, just to bring it to your summary of what it does, this basically tries to allow for the banking industry to engage with the businesses involved in the legal marijuana industry and allow for vehicles of the different banking instrument by removing the criminal penalties and laws that actually invoke that for this industry and still in statutes. It gives three main entities, which is the OLCC, OHA, and Department of Revenue to interact with the banks in order to allow for all these processes to occur, and then asks DCBS to license and in the same time study in the interim all the impediments for the banking processes that are working for the industry that is newly emerging. So it's primarily, I think, to put it in a nutshell, is trying to make sure that the regulations by the federal government that at this time looks at criminal syndicates, that the state of Oregon does not fit that description by the different regulations.
Okay, thank you. Representative Reed is here. He's the sponsor of this legislation, and I know he's being looked at closely by banks and credit unions. So. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. You will, I think, hear from credit unions and banks as well. As usual, Mazen has done an excellent job of summarizing the legislation. I think we've all been watching the state's efforts at marijuana legalization with interest. We've voted on some additional work from the Measure 91 committee in the House. I suspect you have in the Senate as well. What I really would just stress for you is that this is independent of however you feel about the underlying issue of marijuana legalization. I hope we can all agree that having an entire industry and a growing one at that based on cash is not a good thing. Duffel bags of cash are not good for public safety. They're not good for tax collection. They're not really good for much of anything that is good itself. And I also think it's clear that the best solution here is federal, and maybe you're more optimistic about Congress's inclination to act on this than I am, but I don't want to wait. So as Mazen has said, the bill does two things, removing criminal liability from state statute for providing banking services to legal cannabis businesses and asking DCBS to study what our options are going forward. I think it's a responsible thing for us to do. We have a -6 amendment that I came in a little bit late. Mazen may have also described. Doesn't change the intent of the legislation at all, but clarifies some definitions and makes some references that we simply ran out of time to correct in the House. So I hope you'll support the bill and move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And as you noted on revenue impact statement by the very independent Legislative Revenue Office, it says this is a great advance in the efficiency of keeping books and records. Mm-hmm. Almost a departure from your very neutral, independent. I wasn't going out on the limb.
Must have been doing the product, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Representative Reed?
I have a question of staff, just to clarify. Definition under this bill for financial institutions, DCBS covers both deposit companies, which there's three in the state, which are used in Colorado for this exact purposes, and then they also, of course, have the state-regulated bank. So does the definition in here include all of the financial institutions under DCBS, both deposit and banking? Or does Representative Reed know the answer?
I think Senator... It does, and I also asked DCBS to be here to answer any specific questions in case that you wanted to.
They're coming.
Mr. Chair, may I approach? Just for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell. I'm with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and my understanding of the Dash 6 is, as it has been all along, is that all depository institutions, banks and credit unions are covered. Money transmitters are not, they're a non-bank financial entity, but they are also included for purposes of this law. So,
follow-up question.
Follow-up.
Just out of curiosity, because, you know, I have plenty of time, as I've said on the floor, with the five old white men here on the committee. So is there any legal opinions from legislative counsel that tell us that this is, that we could be liable for this if we do it, i.e. the federal government say you can't do this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I am not an attorney, but I'll tell you what my experience so far has been. The federal action, and I hope my friends from the bankers and credit unions can correct anything I get wrong here, is acting under essentially two things, the Cole memo from the Department of Justice and regulation from FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, which essentially say, if you do these things, and there's a long list of things, then we probably won't enforce. But that's sort of like the proverbial yellow light, and that's, I don't want to represent to you that this is going to change the world, but we have heard testimony that this will make things slightly better. And frankly, I think it doesn't make sense in our state statute to continue saying providing banking services for a business that we've said elsewhere in statute is legal, is consistent. So, again, I think the ultimate best solution is going to be federal action. But until that happens, I think this is an appropriate thing for us to do.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Crusher. Just for clarification, I fully concur with and am aware of what Representative Reed has said right here, and I'm fully happy for all of those fine financial institutions to sink or swim with the FBI myself. I just want to ensure that on the record that those members of the legislature here are doing this in legislative business, and it's legislative counsel who's going to have to defend us if the feds don't like what we do. So thank you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Keep you on standby.
Oh, I will be in the back.
Let's call up Brian Doherty, Kevin Christensen, and Pam Levitt. Both, you have four chairs.
Kevin, go ahead.
You on it?
Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead.
I'll take this one.
Okay.
Who can sit far enough away from the mic, I guess.
Okay.
I just, before they start, Mr. I just want to point out that the credit unions are sitting next to the banks. It's a rarity in this room. I just want you to know that. Like, I don't think I've ever seen this before.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association, and we're here today to support the bill and the Dash 6 Amendment, which we worked on with Representative Reed and his staff. State laws legalizing marijuana use and legalizing the production and distribution have left credit unions and all financial institutions in a bind. Many businesses that have been created in Oregon are in need of financial services in order to operate successfully. successfully. Financial institutions face substantial difficulties in providing those services due to intense compliance regulations at the federal level. Guidance issued under the U.S. Department of Justice, specifically, as Representative Reed mentioned, the Cole memo, and related guidance called FinCEN are at the heart of these concerns. The guidance imposes substantial due diligence and monitoring requirements in serving marijuana-related businesses, but does not provide the safe harbor from potential criminal repercussions. We support this bill because it is a step in the right direction. We certainly understand that federal guidance and more clarity at the federal level is needed. Senators Wyden and Merkley have introduced their own legislation to move the ball in this direction. Actually, in the 2015 legislative session, the Oregon legislature passed a resolution urging Congress to support the development of a solution of the financial issues surrounding the legal marijuana business. So we believe that this bill is an important step here in this session, and we certainly will continue to be supporting the issue at the federal level. I did bring a member of ours from MAPS Credit Union who are actually serving these businesses, and he has some testimony about his experience. So, Alan, why don't we switch?
Oh, okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Haas, and members of the committee. My name is Alan Hansen. I'm the general counsel of MAPS Credit Union. We're a state chartered credit union serving approximately 52,000 members here in Oregon, and we currently serve Oregon Health Authority licensed medicinal cannabis dispensaries. We're here to support this bill. We think it's very important to remove all impediments for the banking industry to move forward serving this business, since it's now legal under state law. The most important provisions of this bill are the information sharing between Oregon Health Authority and the OLCC. Under the Cole memo and the FinCEN guidelines, that information sharing is key to us for our ability to continue to comply with those guidelines. This provision would make the Oregon law similar to Washington laws and make the whole process very transparent. And again, MAPS has always remained neutral on the position of whether to legalize marijuana, but we do support this bill. Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Kevin Christensen with the Oregon Bankers Committee Association, and we are supportive of House Bill 4094 with the -6 amendment. I think this is a nice step as far as moving forward in terms of both the information sharing quality and also with respect to the criminal liability of reducing threats to financial institutions who may bank legitimate marijuana businesses. That being said, I think, as has been noted previously, there are still federal impediments, not the least of which is the Federal Controlled Substances Act, which still lists marijuana as a Schedule I drug. And so while this is, I think, a step in the right direction, there is action that really needs to be taken on the federal level. As Pam said, there has been efforts by our delegation to move forward with that legislation. I can't report to you any progress at this point, but I think as marijuana becomes legal in its different forms in different states, perhaps there will be some momentum to make those changes. At this point, given those federal concerns, there is some reticence for banks to become involved in banking marijuana-related businesses. That being said, this is, as Pam said, and we agree, a step in the right direction. We do appreciate Representative Reed's leadership on this. I think Representative Wilson also played a part, so we would definitely support it and urge you to pass.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Brian Doherty with the law firm of Miller, Nash, Graham & Dunn, testifying on behalf of our client, PayQuick, LLC. They are a money transmitter licensed by the U.S. Treasury, as well as have gone into the state of Washington and are registered there as a money transmitter. And they are defined under this bill as a financial institution for purposes of their program. We support the bill with the -6 amendments. PayQuick provides an electronic payment platform that can cover everything from consumer back to the producer and the processor, the wholesaler, the retailer, through a credit system. They operate in Washington with two community banks. They have a PayQuick subaccount and then subaccounts for consumers and the vendors. I'll call the others the processors, others vendors. And they are keenly aware of and are complying with the FinCEN guidelines and the Cole Memorandum. They provide a stringent review of these vendors before going on it to make sure that they are in compliance. They do quarterly reviews. We have an article attached to my testimony about their operation in the state of Washington. They are very keenly aware that this is a step in the right direction. It is not a bulletproof protection. And they're very interested in getting Oregon's seed-to-sale traceability system operational, which is a key component of this as well, to make sure that that the vendors, the public, and this company are complying with the FinCEN guidelines. I'd be happy to answer any of the questions and appreciate the time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? Okay, thank you all. That's all that signed up to testify on this bill. We still don't have any of the required paperwork for the DASH 6 amendment, so we'll carry this over to tomorrow. Hopefully we'll have it then. Thank you, Maza. Close the work session and public hearing. Senator Borquist?
I'm assuming DOR is okay with this and with this particular bill, and they're able to... they're hopeful that they'll be able to collect taxes when they do this. So.
Okay. Thanks, Referee. I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1533. Last we checked in on this story, the Dash 4s were... consensus amendment. Now there's being work on the Dash 5s, which I understand are not complete. I know the phone lines were buzzing all weekend, and I very much appreciate all the principals working together toward compromise, but we are not there yet. Tomorrow was our self-imposed deadline for a bipartisan bill, so hopefully today we'll produce some changes. In the meantime, we still have some people who didn't get a chance who would like to weigh in on the underlying bill of 1533. So we'll go through that list. Do you have any new developments, Kyle?
No. Okay. Just got a proof.
Okay. So let's start off with Peggy Lynch, Aaron Dale, and Russ Dondero.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. And today we will have day at the legislature, so there will be League members wandering the halls and hopefully knocking on some of your doors about issues about which they care. I'm here today to talk about 1533A, and I understand now that the Dash 4s are being set aside probably. But I want to make a couple of points. The League was supportive that the amendments adopted in the Senate Human Services provide local governments with a choice of developer incentives. We support considerations to developers in order to help with this housing crisis, but each jurisdiction has a unique relationship with its development community and may want to use different mechanisms to assure affordable housing inclusion. The League encourages the legislature to give localities the freedom to make their own decisions on whether and how they implement the policy. At the same time, local jurisdictions should be allowed to consider inclusionary zoning as part of a broader set of affordable housing policies. The issues that we have around the Dash 4s, for instance, is just a reminder, you as the fiscal side of things understand that issue more than others in this building. SDCs actually pay for something. So if, in fact, there is an opportunity that local jurisdictions want to forgive or forego some SDCs, they should have that conversation locally. But the whole reason that we have systems development charges is that they pay to help make sure that we have water and sewer and transportation, et cetera. The other thing I want to remind you that is that property taxes actually pay for services. So if a local jurisdiction wants to forego some property taxes in order to have affordable housing, if that's a balance in their community, they should have the opportunity to have that conversation. But property taxes pay for police and fire and other important services. So what we are concerned about is making sure that local governments, and you know, how much compression has happened, how property taxes are now limiting the amount of money that local governments have to pay for those important services. So we need to give them the flexibility, as much flexibility as possible, as we lift this ban on inclusionary zoning, a ban, by the way, that for which the public got nothing in return when the ban was implemented in 1999. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. We work on behalf of all 242 cities to find policies that allow local governments to solve local problems using the things that work best in their communities. We support the foundation within Senate Bill 1533A. The Dash A4s raise a lot of concerns for a number of my communities that have been supportive of lifting the ban on inclusionary zoning. In particular, they want a tool that's going to work in their communities, and a lot of our communities aren't looking at 20 units coming in fairly regularly in which they can flex this tool to work within their community. So they many have expressed an interest of keeping that 10-unit threshold, but recognize that that ship might have sailed at this point, but we would like to keep that issue open for future consideration, as if this bill passes and some of our cities start implementing these programs and find that it works, if there are ways to finance it, that would be better. We recognize that there are offsets and sideboards because of concerns that if we do too much too aggressively at the local level, that will somehow disincentivize growth, and that's generally not what my cities want to see right now. All of my cities are looking at their housing supplies, looking at what they do and don't have, and who can and cannot afford to live and work within the city boundaries. So we want an IZ proposal that does have, if it's going to have sideboards and restrictions, ones that are flexible enough for the local government to look at its own resources and determine how to best offset the cost to the builders when we demand that they include affordable housing within their units or pay a fee in lieu. Many of my cities have reached out over the last few days in looking at the Dash A4s and said that this is becoming so inflexible that they're not sure that they can support this bill, even if it does lift a preemption, even though our core mission is, of course, to create as much local tools as possible. But if it's a preemption in the statute versus a preemption in practice, it makes little difference to those communities. One thing I will say in the A4s regarding the clear and objective standards that were discussed at the last hearing, clear and objective standards are already a requirement that all cities have to have a clear and objective path for residential development. In the last, in the 2015 session, there was a tool provided in a bill that this legislature passed that said that if we don't have that clear and objective standard, there's a new enforcement mechanism that a developer or someone who's concerned that we're not providing that pathway can go directly to LCDC and ask for an enforcement order. The other piece of that, though, is that the statute clearly states that while we have to have a clear and objective path forward, we're allowed to create a discretionary path if we want to. And that discretionary path is super important when you're talking about things like height bonusing or density changes, because that's the discretion that we're talking about. So for some of these tools to work, you have to keep not just the clear and objective standards, but also the ability to do discretionary conversations with the developers so that maybe what would have been a 4-story building becomes a 7-story building and you get twice as many units out of the project. So having that limited to only clear and objective standards is a significant problem, and I believe there's work on that in this latest version of what might possibly become an amendment to this bill for tomorrow. we're looking forward to seeing if these negotiations lead to enough flexibility within the offsets program so that we can adjust and work with developers within our communities when we are doing these offsets, so that each project pencils out, because each project will be different. An SDC waiver might be most beneficial in one project but not in another, and we want the flexibility to be able to do that, because when we do waive SDCs, we have to pay that back. That doesn't just come, like, we don't just waive the fee and it goes away. We are required to backfill that money from our general fund. So all of these offsets do have a public cost, and those dollars come from somewhere. So the one thing that I think is beneficial is the release on the construction excise tax. We are still a little bit concerned that it might be slightly too prescriptive in how the residential dollars are spent. With that 50% going towards specifically IZ offsets, we want to make sure that the language is written correctly so that it's not that you have to adopt an IZ program in order to do a residential construction excise tax. The construction excise tax could be a very powerful tool for some of our communities to find a way to build a fund to help do a lot of affordable housing building or help builders who are looking at doing affordable housing. By providing some city funds, something that most of our cities haven't been able to do. But if you look at what the city of Bend has been able to accomplish with their 1/3 of 1% construction excise tax that goes directly to affordable housing, they have raised, because it is a very hot construction market, they've been able to raise a large amount of money that is building actual units of affordable housing within the city, which is very important in that community. It will be dependent on the building market, and I think our cities that don't have quite as robust of a building market as Portland or Bend are probably going to be leery that anything that they would add on top of the cost to build would, you know, inhibit building, and that's exactly the opposite point that most of our cities have had. There's a lot in this package that we're of bills that aren't before this committee that we're still concerned with, but I would like to finally state that any adoption of an inclusionary housing policy or a construction excise tax at the local level will take a local public conversation. Our city councils can't work in the dark and say, this is what we're going to do, and there's no public hearing on the process. They can't walk through a grocery store without hearing from someone that, you know, I don't like this, or I think this is great. So our local governments, being local, hear these conversations in the public, whether they want to or not. And then they're required to have a public process when adopting these programs. So there will be a robust conversation about what will and won't work at the local level. And that's the opportunity that we're asking for in lifting the preemption on inclusionary housing and lifting the preemption on the construction excise tax. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Aaron, the city of Bend's record is really inspirational, almost, and they're doing it without any new laws. Do they do inclusionary zone? How does that work? And they're doing this without
Chair Haas, they were Ben's program is just simply a construction excise tax, and they were grandfathered in before the preemption was put in place in 2007, and they had set that rate working with the development community, is my understanding, at 1/3 of 1%. At this time, they can't change that percentage, they can't change that allocation, because they are under that. Anytime anyone tries to attempt to change anything, a lawsuit is pretty much immediately threatened and the discussion goes away. So they aren't using any inclusionary housing programs, but they are working within their planning code and with nonprofit developers and for-profit developers to find both the land and the resources to develop that housing.
And wasn't the land public?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think the last land was public, and the one that's happening right now, I think, was public land.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Russ Dondero. I live in Forest Grove, Oregon, and I'm a citizen concerned about housing and housing-related issues. I've submitted written testimony on Friday, which details my concerns with the existing 1533A and the -4, which I oppose at this point, not being aware or having seen or participated in discussions on the -5. I'll reserve my opinions about that when I see it. But My concerns are as follows. I think I associate my concerns and comments with what you just heard. I think local control is the essence of this bill in its original form, with that was submitted during the interim and initially in the House. So I think the more we can keep enable local communities to have options, the better we are. But the bottom line is I don't see the current version, the A version, or the Dash 4 doing anything for those most in need of affordable housing here in Oregon, particularly those with incomes that are below the 80% of median family income or those who live below the poverty line. In fact, I'm very concerned with the Dash 4 because it specifically states it's intended to target those at 80% and above. So that's particularly concerning, and I've stated that for the record and my reasons. I've given each of you through the staff a handout which details the number of people in each of your districts and the counties you represent who live below the poverty line. And it's not a pretty picture any more than is Oregon a pretty picture in terms of poverty. So you will see that aside from Washington County, each of the counties represented by you as members representing those folks in those communities have people living below the poverty line that is higher than the state average and considerably higher. I was surprised to see that Lane County and Josephine County's poverty rates are higher than my own home county, Douglas County, where I grew up in the late 50s and early 60s. When Roseburg was the timber capital of the nation and the economy was considerably better than it is now. Sadly, that's changed. While Washington County, where I've lived now for 42 years, fares better, the statistics belie the reality that in my home county, there are two realities. Those who live well above the poverty line have excellent jobs with our traded sector companies and those who service them, and then people like in my community of Forest Grove, which we have 21% of the people in our community living below the poverty line, not unlike many of the counties in Oregon. So Washington County is a sort of a tale of two cities. For some, it's the best of times. For others, it's the worst of times. The chief causes of homelessness and housing insecurity is the lack of affordable housing. This has been documented by national studies time and time again. The fact is that this has been made worse in our country since the Vietnam War era when LBJ failed to deliver on the promise of community-based mental health. And many people in the housing and homeless community, and many of you and our local leaders, are concerned about the number of people who are homeless who are clearly off their meds and not being cared for. And then in the Reagan administration and subsequent Democratic administrations, including the Clinton administration, we stopped building public housing, which was, after World War II, when the GIs came home, was the primary vehicle, along with FHA loans, for getting our GIs and their families into housing. This is why inclusionary zoning is so important. It offers a light at the end of the tunnel of housing insecurity by creating public, private, and I would say local partnerships to build below-market rental housing and mixed housing developments. This, again, is why I can't support the A and Gross version, nor the Dash 4. I'm really concerned that as I read the language of the bill since the original bill, it seems to me to privilege the industry over the public. And ultimately, you as public servants need to be concerned about what's the best for the public. When you walk into the rotunda of this building, it says the following, and this will be my conclusion. In the souls of its citizens will be found the likeness of the state, which if they be unjust and tyrannical, then it will reflect their vices. But if they be lovers of righteousness, confident in their liberties, so will it be clear in justice and bold in freedom. I think it's time to do justice and inclusionary zoning, to me, done the right way, is a step toward getting justice for people who are desperately in need. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. All right. Negotiations among the principals and the Speaker's office, Senator Denbrough, the City of Portland, and many others continue today. I hope we can reach some consensus, and I hope it's something that we can get a unanimous vote on sometime in our lifetime, if not tomorrow. So we have no other business before us. We will carry this bill, Senate Bill 1533, over, and we will carry over House Bill 4094 for tomorrow. We are adjourned. We are adjourned.